Folks, we've heard some jaw-dropping stories on the show before, but sometimes the stories our own minds tell us can be the most jaw-dropping of all. If you've ever been caught off guard by disturbing, unwanted thoughts, you might know what we mean. When something violent or taboo or embarrassing bursts into your mind, it can leave you reeling and wondering, what is that thought say about me? Well, that happens to almost everyone, but for people with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, they tend to cause a lot of distress and feel impossible to stop thinking about. A good friend of mine has OCD, so I've witnessed this struggle up close, and it's taught me a lot about how serious and misunderstood the condition is. People think OCD is only about hand washing or organization. OCD can latch onto anything, but it often focuses on the things we care about most. In an attempt to make the distress from their unwanted thoughts go away, people with OCD will often engage in repetitive physical or mental behaviors, known as compulsions, which can be incredibly time-consuming and exhausting. OCD is highly treatable, but it needs specialized treatment. NoCD is a virtual therapy provider for OCD that makes getting specialized therapy easier than ever. With NoCD, you can do live, face-to-face video therapy with licensed therapists who specialize in OCD. Exposure and response prevention, or ERP, a type of therapy that was designed specifically to treat OCD, is considered the gold standard treatment, and that's available through NoCD. NoCD accepts many major insurance plans and offers always-on support between sessions. If you think you might be struggling with OCD and want to learn more about therapy with NoCD, go to NoCD.com and schedule a free 15-minute call with their team. That's NoCD.com to learn more and book a free 15-minute call.
Despite my incredible advertising voice, it doesn't sell B2B. And advertising on the wrong platform doesn't sell B2B either. That's why if you're a B2B marketer, you should use LinkedIn ads. With LinkedIn ads, you'll be able to target over 130 million decision makers all in one place. No incredible advertising voice required. Get started today and see why LinkedIn is the place to be to be. We'll even give you £100 off your first campaign. Go to linkedin.com/lead to claim your credit. Terms and conditions apply.
You all right, guys?
I need the
kitchen.
The office.
The lounge.
The living room for a meeting.
For my spin class.
For my live stream.
For my game.
I need it to watch the footy.
When everyone's caning the broadband, EE's new Wi-Fi 7 router makes every device work better, even yours.
Hello, guys.
And knead the dough like this.
Turn it up. Let's go, team.
New Smart Wi-Fi Pro, exclusively from EE.
43.7% UK availability. Smart Hub Pro and Smart Wi-Fi Pro available with selected EE full fibre plans. Terms apply.
Hey, folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Dr. Ray Christian, your guest host for this special episode of Risk, in honor of Veterans Day, coming up here in a few days. Every Thursday, Risk releases an episode that looks back at content from the earlier years of the podcast, and so this week, we'll be taking a look at a couple of the best of veteran stories. I happen to be a combat veteran myself. I served for 20 years in the Army as an infantryman and a paratrooper, joined when I was 17 right out of high school. Recording this episode was a bit of a challenge, because my community of Boone, North Carolina was heavily impacted by Hurricane Helene, with roads destroyed, property lost, and massive power outages. But we continue with the mission of recovery. So I've got two stories to share with you today. In a little bit, we're going to hear a story from Jesse Martinez, but we're going to start with a story from Dario DiBattista, who told this story on Risk back in January 2017. It's a story we called One Bullet.
I joined the Marines in peacetime. I graduated boot camp on August 24th, 2001. If I'm being honest with you, I probably would have not joined the Marines after September 11th, 2001. Because the Marines are a warfighting force. They pride themselves as being one of the baddest branches of the military. And when you're in the Marines, they will put you in the front lines and you'll be in the dangerous areas. And that's your expectation. When we were getting ready to train, one of our staff sergeants asked, who is afraid? And of course, nobody raised their hand. He said, who's not afraid? And of course, nobody raised their hand. He's like, good. You're supposed to be scared. If you're not scared, you're a crazy motherfucker, and I don't want you coming with me. A lot of times, people ask if I've ever killed anybody, which is... it's an egregious question to ask somebody. Why would you do that? If I did kill somebody, do you think I want to talk about it? If I didn't kill anybody, my experience is not worth anything all of a sudden. It's this weird, gross oversimplification of what we do and how we did it and what the job was. It's about nation building, it's about stability, it's about creating peace and security and a functioning government for people, not just going around shooting people. You know, there's a boredom to war. You can be in a house going room to room, tense combat that feels like hours, but it's only about 10 minutes. And then you might sit around for 4 hours, literally. Just the manic bipolar transition that just really fucks you up. Everybody who goes through a war zone comes home, and at least for a time, they're disturbed. A car's tailpipe might set you off. You might be jittery when you're in a crowd. If you don't have these symptoms, you're crazy. You're a sociopath. There's no other way to describe it. Having a heightened sense of being able to transition quickly from placid, calm, confident to a professional killer instinct at a snap protects you. It's a good skill, but it's hard to unlearn. It's hard to come home and be calm and poised and not equate everything to life or death. It's hard to come home and sit with your back to a wall at a restaurant, not looking who's coming in, who's going out. But that high you get, that rock solid hard on from coming home and being alive, is unlike anything I could ever describe. But it doesn't last long because people don't understand where you've come from. They won't take the time to consider what you've done. They treat it like this sacrosanct, unapproachable experience, and nobody calls you out for drinking too much. Nobody calls you out for being angry and irritable. Nobody calls you out for your violent mood swings that once protected you, and now they make you a social pariah. When I was overseas, I was in love. I had met somebody before I left. Even though I served in combat, even though I did two tours, I was a Marine reservist, which meant I was basically a civilian college student and also a warfighter at the same time. I'd go from Chili's to places like Fallujah. I'd go from the Syrian border of Iraq to a community college. I met a young woman before I left. She was a hostess at the restaurant where I worked at. She was sweet. She'd always give me the good tables, even though I didn't ask, you know, or the people she thought would tip really well. We would get food to go, we'd go back to my house, and I was 19, so I'd put on some jazz music and a candle, and I thought that was romantic, and she would brush her teeth when we were done. which I just felt was so cool, just so honest, so open. Like, yeah, okay. Let's go mess around. Like, okay, shit. I'm down with that. Spent my entire last day with her. She came with me on all my errands, all of my activities. A lot of that meant her sitting in a car on a military base, just waiting for me to get gear, receive gear, collect stuff. And I held her. I held her that night. That was it. There's not a lot to say, but I did tell her that she should live her life and forget about me. But she didn't. She reached out to my sister, who she found online, and got my address before anybody else got my address somehow, and she wrote me every single day. And she marked the envelopes with lipstick. She drew me paintings of Marine dress uniforms and swords. And then she would always sign her name with the nickname I gave her, Cinnamon Girl, which I thought was pretty smart, right? I used to be a drummer back then. She used to love that I drummed. And there's a lyric in the song. The drummer relaxes and waits between shows for his Cinnamon Girl. So I wanted to be with her more than anything. But sometimes I would say, hey, let's go out as friends. I would push her away, flipping from I love you, let's talk about our future one day, to not talking to her for days, to not wanting to hang out with her family. Her sister was dating a Marine at the time, and I don't know why, I just didn't want to be around another Marine. I didn't want to hang out with her family and him. A symptom of PTSD is avoidance, not wanting to be around things that remind you of bad experiences. I didn't know how to explain it, but I knew I was not right. I knew that I felt off. And again, I didn't want to involve her in that part of my life. I slowly began drinking a lot. I slowly began giving less of a shit. And I slowly found myself being angry, unable to control my emotions, and just oscillating between extremes, just total jubilation to depression. I found out about a month after I came home, one of the Marines I served with who stayed behind was killed by a suicide bomber. I threw my phone against the wall, exploding the parts. Another one of my friends was killed later, my friend Mike. His helicopter crashed. Last time I saw him, he just finished infantry training. And I traced my finger on his PFC mark. It's a chevron that goes on the shoulder. And I was proud of him. His funeral was a closed casket funeral. And me and a friend of his, we just drank. We just drank a lot. One late night, shitty night like any other, a lot of Red Bulls and vodkas, heart racing, mind racing. I like that drink because it just made me feel really fucked up. And I saw a photo of her. She's a photographer, she's well versed in Photoshop, so it's stunning, it's beautiful, all blemishes removed. Her eyes, her blue eyes, accented. And her hair. Really red hair. Really red, bold, scarlet hair. When I had come home originally, she had dyed her hair back to blonde. And after we broke up, she kept it that way. And I was red again. I felt like she did it because she knew I'd see it. She knew it was a way to passive-aggressively give me a finger. Fuck you, dude. I just wanted things to be right. I wanted things to be back to normal. Because everything sucks. And I struggle through my day-to-day. But this is the one thing that I think could be a savior. Could get me right again. to make me feel like I used to feel. She wouldn't give me that, but I didn't deserve it because I was the one who had fucked shit up. And I felt about my daily depression, drinking so much, trying not to wake up, but somehow always being there. The following day, putting whatever fragments of myself I had together to go to a restaurant, to smile, to be polite. Hey, chief, will you get me a Coke? Fuck yourself, I'm not a chief. I'm a Lance Corporal in the Marines, don't patronize me. And they would always play our song on the rafters, Cinnamon Girl, every night. I'd get in fights with my coworkers, and I'd be put in the office a lot. The only reason I had a job is because they took pity on me. The young crazy vet, just come home. We'd go out and we'd drink again, and I would drink, and I did not want to think about her. But I would only talk to the girls who reminded me of her, the ones that looked like her. Because that was my marker. It was my marker to home, and she didn't want me, and I did not see a redemption anymore. I bought a rifle, and I bought one bullet, but I knew that bullet was never for home defense, it was for me. And I closed the door to my room, and I sat on my bed, and I loaded a round into the chamber. And I stared. And your bones feel hard and numb. And time felt like it was not moving at all. But all I could see at the end of the barrel was my mom. My mom's face. And I thought about what she would look like at my funeral. She used to say, Dario, if you ever get captured, I'm gonna come over there and I'm gonna go rescue you. She's old. And like 4'11". What a ridiculous thing to say. And she said, we'll get you back. If you died, I'm going to bury you with a sword. I wasn't a corporal. I didn't rate a sword. But she wanted to give me a sword because she was proud of me. I saw Mike's mom at his funeral. And I didn't know her. I had never met her before that day. And it's cliche, but they say the eyes are a window to the soul, and when you look into the eyes of a mother who has just lost her son, there is a vacancy that is painful to look at. And because that darkness, I don't feel is ever going to be replaced, because why should it? What an awful, awful experience. There's no lesson in that. There's no go live your life better. There's no keep doing the mission. To honor him. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it to my mom. I still wanted to die, but I wasn't going to do it myself, so I volunteered for war again. And even though I was not making out with anybody, I got sick with mono. And, you can't go fight a war with mono because you're fatigued and you can't stay focused and your spleen can explode. I swear to you, if I had a broken leg, I would have gone. If I had pneumonia, I would have gone. I was suicidal, but I didn't want to get anybody else killed. So I stayed behind. The guys who went in my stead got really fucked up. One of them lost a leg. One of them wound up dying later, got shot in the neck. Our officer in charge got shot in the face. Somebody hit him in the small space between the helmet and the neck guard of a flak vest, rupturing the front of his face, destroying his jaw. I saw him at a military hospital on the Marine Corps birthday. He didn't have a face, it was just a tongue. And his sister would dutifully suction every so often, and he would write with a pen and paper, "This place is busy." At some point, I just got tired of feeling like shit, feeling awful, feeling suffocated by depression, by sadness, by this inability to reclaim my life, get back to who I thought I could be, maybe become who I wanted to be. I realized at some point you just gotta unfuck yourself. So I went to college in Connecticut, having not known anybody in Connecticut, and thankfully I found some people who encouraged me to write, and I started writing. And I've learned you have to control your story or your story controls you. I still keep the bullet. It's in a jar of things that make up my life. And there is keepsakes from every job I've ever worked. A note a girl gave me in high school. She wrote, "Keep this forever," so I did. My old class ring. My old dog tags wrapped around tape so they didn't clank together while on patrol. A map of the Appalachian Trail. Other secret things. I want to show this jar to the woman that I will marry one day. I will want to show her how important my life is when measured against the bullet. People might not challenge you. They'll say, "Oh, he's been to war. They've done tough stuff." But you still gotta make that choice for you. Because if you find yourself like I did, staring down a barrel, that's not good for you or anybody else. Because if you kill yourself at home, it still counts for the enemy. It's a 6,000 mile sniper shot. The difference is it came from your own gun.
This is Dan Savage, host of the Savage Lovecast, and it's pretty simple. You ask...
Calling for advice on having sex while traveling.
What pants should I wear? How do I navigate socks, you know, if I have to take off my socks at any point?
And I answer. A dick can be too big, guys. Dicks can be impractically large. Butts have cracks in them. Sex toys shouldn't have cracks in them. Yeah, you're gonna need headphones.
The Savage Lovecast, every Tuesday.
Welcome back to Risk. I'm your host for this episode, Ray Christian. And before the break, we heard Dario Batista's One Bullet. You know, it can be very difficult to describe the intense feeling of fear, anxiety, and despair one can feel constantly when suffering from PTSD, and the impact it can have on the person and their relationships with other people. Okay. Next is that story from Jesse Martinez I mentioned, and I have a few thoughts on that one too, which I'll share with you afterwards. So here's his story, which first appeared on the podcast way back in 2016. It's one we call "He's My Brother."
Then we were looking for about about 5 minutes, just in horror at what happened, saw a second jet coming from the west, and it smashed right into the second building.
Now we're all standing out. We're staring at the building, all of us, in horror.
Yeah. It's the only way to describe it. Horror, sadness, and disgust.
You talked about fear and being scared.
What next?
And feelings of vulnerability.
Two huge planes crash into the World Trade Center. What's going to happen next?
Mr. Russo, thank you very much for talking with us. As we look back up at the World Trade Center, and I know you can see it better with helicopters, but you can see it from the ground here as well.
My world was shattered on September 11th. I was only in 7th grade. I was getting ready for school, and I remember looking on the TV, and it's one hell of a thing to see the towers burning and not even understanding what it meant. You see the little black dots falling from the sky, and I didn't understand that those were people. And my mom walked by. I remember she just looked at me. She just shook her head and said it was awful, but I didn't even understand what was awful. We went to school, and then we just watched what was going on in the news the whole time in class. They didn't talk to us about what was going on or what it meant or who did it or anything like that. We were just watching these screens of towers falling and people flying out of the fucking sky. I'm shaking just thinking about it. It sort of ended my childhood that day. So the next few years, I just watched the news. I mean, I was horrified and scared, but I couldn't look away. It changed me. It gave me a sense of purpose that I didn't have yet. Maybe I shouldn't have had it at that age, but I wanted to fucking kill these fucking Muslim fucking terrorists. And so in 2010, I left. And I left to kill. I was angry before September 11th, and I was angry for various reasons afterwards with my life and how it was going, and leaving for the army was a dream for me. My father is a habitual drug user, and my mother left him when I was 5. And then my sister died when I was in high school. I was definitely angry already, so it's nothing the army gave me or what terrorists did that day. I didn't want to be some career soldier. I thought that I could be used as a tool to kill as many as I could, and I wanted to kill as many as I could. I was solely prepared to die, and in fact, I thought that might be the only death that people would remember me for. I was on a lunch break from my grocery store job, and I went to the army recruiter. I didn't know what I wanted to be. I thought maybe I could be one of those machine door gunners on a helicopter. He told me I couldn't, so then I was just thinking of infantry. And the recruiter told me, well, check out the cavalry scouts before you make a final decision. And I watched the video, and I was unsure, and then he said, well, you're going to be able to kill a lot of people if you're a cavalry scout, and you won't be able to do that if you're in the infantry. And so I said, all right, let's do it. So about 3.5 months into deployment, it wasn't what I had anticipated. The Taliban, they weren't coming out to fight on the terms and that I had wanted. They're only leaving IEDs and not really any gunfire. And I was bored. There was nothing to do. You just sit around when you're not on mission and you're jacking off, you're exchanging pornography, you're smoking cigarettes, you're working out, you're sleeping, you're eating, you're shitting. I didn't feel like I was doing what I was assigned to do or what I should be doing. I felt as though I was being wasted and our time was being wasted. So any sort of distraction was a godsend. We would exchange videos and porn files off of our laptops and external hard drives. This one day, I call him Smith. He was in our troop. Smith was a specialist and he was a gunner. And I didn't particularly like him the first time I met him. He didn't rub me in the right way. So Smith gave his laptop to a couple of my friends. Before he did, he had thrown away something in the trash bin. And so my friends, they were browsing the laptop for porn and stuff, and then they remembered, like good scouts, that they had to check what was in that trash bin that he left there. And so they opened it up and they found a video file. It was a webcam. And all you could see was the neck down of a man, and he is completely naked. And he starts putting condoms on random items you would find in a room. Shampoo bottles, the case that you would put a toothbrush in, the toothbrush, then other things that are more specific, dildos and butt plugs. And he put condoms on all these things, and then he started putting him up his ass. And they were laughing. They were having a good old time. And then they realized, wait a minute, that chair looks a lot like the chair we had in the hallway in Germany. And so now they're really interested. And this is a pretty long video, so they start skipping around to see if they can, this guy ever shows his face. And towards the end, the climax, I guess you could say, he has a bat. And he puts the larger end of the bat in his ass. And they are just roaring with laughter. And before the video ends, he gets up from the chair and he turns off the webcam, exposing his face. And it's Smith. In a couple of days, everyone around the FOB knows about Smith and his bat. And we're writing Batman logos in the bathroom stalls. We're calling up on the net talking about baseball and Batman. And everybody knows. Everybody knows except for Smith. But then when he does find out, it ends up being one of those moments where you can't take it back. And he realizes to what extent he's been alienated by us. He is extremely angry and understandably very hostile to us in both words and actions. And we're at the picnic table outside the Chew. The Chew is where we sleep. Smith walks by and he overhears us talking about him. He doesn't walk over, but he starts shouting at us. My friend told him, shut the fuck up. Go stick another baseball bat up your ass. And they get in a shouting match, and eventually Smith just walks away. So it ends up being almost a month after the video is out that Smith actually talks to the commanders, and he goes above our own unit, above our captain, and he ends up talking to, I believe, the commander of the FOB we were at. I'm sorry, when I'm saying FOB, I'm saying Forward Operating Base, which comprises many different units. And that's when they start giving out the orders and threats that anyone who talks about it, anyone who shares the video, is going to be in trouble. But they were largely ineffective because everyone's still laughing about it. So he's got another 6 months with us. He started eating lunch alone. Actually, his best friend was my roommate. And so I made no qualms telling him what I thought about Smith or the fact that he was hanging out with Smith. I'm sure I said something like, did he stick a bat up your ass or did you film it or something like that. Everyone was masturbating. Pretty much everyone in my platoon had a fleshlight. You wouldn't believe how many dudes have gotten other dudes' semen all over their hands trying to figure out what the fuck those things were. When they pick him up in the room, and then you just get fucking a load of another dude's fucking cold, thick, sticky fucking semen all over their hands. That happened a lot. We would actually have times prescribed for one another to jerk off. I would tell my roommate, I'm feeling like I need to jerk off, or I'm starting to get hard. So can you leave the room? And they would go to have a cigarette, and I would too for them. Afghanistan has more American seamen than most bathhouses in America. And we all knew it. We would laugh about it. There is something remarkable when you're shitting and showering and jerking off just a few feet away from someone who could save your life. It can bring brothers together. The Army is a pretty amazing organization. When you think about it, what the job that it has to do and then the conditions and standards in which it has to accomplish it is astronomical. You're asking these people from all different backgrounds and colors and creeds and economic standings and social classes, and you're asking them to work together under the worst circumstances possible. And one of the ways I think that we accomplish that is because we're fucking cruel. We don't hide who we are. We don't hide how we feel about things, even though we know we're generally ignorant or wrong. We still like lashing out sometimes, and sometimes it takes in the forms of jokes. So joking about a specific racial stereotype or whatever, and then not being offended, being able to understand a little bit where that person is coming from because you haven't had a whole lot of dealings with that other person's race, and so you might have your own stereotypes about them. It creates a different sort of friendship and bond that isn't like that I've ever had as a civilian. That, I guess, sort of mellowed me out a little bit because you were able to make some amazing brothers, and I don't feel as angry anymore. I don't feel as alone is probably one of the reasons why. It's because I do have these brothers now, and it's because they've been able to call me a wetbag or a spick or a beaner, and I've never cared, and I was able to call them whatever the fuck they are. All that stuff is great when it's working right, but when it came to Smith, we dropped the ball because he didn't have that brotherhood. He didn't have that feeling that I feel now and I felt at the time, where I felt secure, I felt safe, I felt like no matter what, these guys had my back. They can say whatever they want, but I know that their fucking actions are gonna back up that oath they took. I don't think we ever once thought Smith was gay or we were attracting any sort of actual hatred of homosexuals, but it stung in a way that it can only sting when you're in a male-dominated combat field being called gay. At the time, no one was out. It might have been sanctioned by the president as being fined, but no one admitted it, at least not in our unit, which is interesting enough because we ended up finding out there was far more homosexuals after deployment than there was during, myself included. While I don't find males necessarily attractive, I have a certain inkling for transsexuals. So, yeah, we made fun of each other about our religion, our sexuality, the way we talked, our job performance. We would use all sort of curse words. Nigger, wetback, kike, gook, sand nigger. There was nothing held back. Which you think we would might think differently when you're saying these words to people who also have guns. But nothing was out of bounds. Smith, unfortunately, he just had the juiciest one where we could all get behind because it was so odd and so peculiar that people who you would think would have some of the most professional standards in the Army, Navy SEALs included, are making fun of him. So Smith, he got sent to a unit that was outside of our own, specifically so he was not harassed anymore. But when those SEAL guys, when they found out, it was just as bad, if not worse, than what was with us.
Pretty soon the whole FOB is asking about Smith and what he did and why he did it or where the video is. That's what everyone wants to know. They all want to see it. But my impression of Smith is that he was a highly narcissistic, prideful person, like many of us are, myself included. And so when you've built up this character and everyone knows you by this character and then suddenly you have one of these flaws, it's shattering to you. And so I remember the first time I met Smith, he was a fucking dick to me. He had already been there for about 6 months in the unit in Germany before I got there. I was green as could be. He tried to intimidate me in a way that I didn't find all that receptive, and so I immediately didn't like him. He challenged me at the motor pool for some reason because I didn't have my uniform in the standard in which he thought was acceptable. He thought he was the shit. Or at least that's what he tried to impress upon us.
After our year-long vacation in Afghanistan, we returned back to Germany, and then subsequently our unit was deactivated as soon as we got back. He went to Georgia, I went to Colorado, but a few of my buddies went with him to Fort Benning. And that's where things really started hitting the fan fast for him. He ends up marrying a woman who had at least one other kid with another guy from our unit who he never acknowledged. Smith doesn't seem at all to be bothered by that. And so he gives away his freedom and ultimately his money and everything he owns, at least 50%, when they end up divorcing a few months after they get back to the States. Then one night, he's drinking and he's driving. He gets pulled over and he decides to run. However, he was drinking in the car and ends up leaving the beer can he was using. So while he got away, his DNA was left on the beer. And he ends up being demoted, gets in trouble for drinking and driving and then running away from a scene. Shortly afterwards, he tries to commit suicide by jumping off a building. I think he ends up only breaking a few bones. And I'm not entirely sure if he ends up getting out honorably or dishonorably, but he ends up leaving the military. And he's still living now with his ex-wife, and I think now they're in Kentucky somewhere. About a year and a half after I get out of the Army, I get a phone call from a friend. He says, "Have you heard?" I said, "Have I heard about what?" "Have you heard about Smith?" "No." And he says, "Smith's dead. He was arrested for child abuse. It wasn't sexually, but it was physically, and it was about to go to trial. He ends up killing himself before he has to face the consequence of his actions." And I remember getting off the phone with my friend and feeling as though I may have played a part in his ultimate demise, letting him down, because while I may not have liked Smith, the Army doesn't care what my opinion. I should have still respected him as a soldier and as a human being. Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, he has a quote that says, "Those who fight monsters should be wary they do not become a monster in the process. For when you look into the abyss also looks into you." And thinking about that quote, it sums up my time in Afghanistan perfectly. Because we were monsters. We were trained to be monsters. The doctrine from Higher, the memos from Petraeus and the others, they may have believed that they were leading us to a hearts and minds mentality, but we went to Afghanistan to destroy. We weren't there to build or to create or to foster goodwill. And so when we couldn't do the things we were designed to do, we ultimately turned on each other. And unfortunately for Smith, he was a primary target. He was one of us. He was someone we should have loved and respected, not for the person, but for the uniform he wore and for the oath he swore. We failed him, and we failed each other for not correcting each other when we saw him being harassed, when other people asked about him and laughed at him. We perpetuated that story so that he didn't have any hope left. He was certainly in hell. He had no one to turn to. He was far from any sort of family he could confide in. We made sure that no friends of his would feel comfortable knowing him or hanging out with him. We all let him down. I can make excuses on me being young or ignorant or arrogant, but I let him down. I let his family down, because he did not come home as a full person as he may have deployed. He came back changed forever, because the brothers that he had sworn to defend the country with didn't consider him a brother, didn't consider him a person worth knowing or caring about. He was fucked. I I remember hanging up the phone and sitting there and looking out the window. I thought about that angry kid I was when I first joined the army, so obsessed with killing. And I remember thinking that Smith was the first person I killed. It wasn't a bad guy, it was Smith, and I still feel that way.
This is Risk, and I'm Ray Christian, and that's Kate Bush's song, Army Dreamers. And before that was He's My Brother by Jesse Martinez. You know, people join the military for many reasons, with multiple outcomes after service. There's education, travel, adventure, and the camaraderie that comes from that common bond that can develop within a group after engaging in a dangerous situation. But feeling that you are outside that group can be depressing and counterproductive for unit cohesion and morale. And Jesse's story is a classic example of being isolated and left out for whatever reason. Shame, embarrassment, or simply being different. Well, that is all for our Best of Veterans Story episode. There's information about both of these storytellers on our website at risk-show.com. And hey, fellow vets, if you've got a story to share, reach out to us and tell them Ray Christian sent you. Everything you need to know about pitching a story to Risk is at risk-show.com/submissions. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ray Christian, and you should check out my podcast, What's Ray Saying? It's a show that uses history and storytelling to explore the Black American experience from the many perspectives of my life. Ghetto kid, soldier, academic, and goat wrangler in the mountains of Appalachia. And now the last thing for me to say is, folks, today's the day. Take a risk.